When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Takeaways. I'm Kirk Cameron. Today, we're going to have an important conversation surrounding our roles and responsibilities as Christians living in a broken world. How do we advocate for our biblical values while fully acknowledging that many around us may not hold the same beliefs? What should we reasonably expect from our neighbors and friends and governing officials whose values may be diametrically opposed to ours? And how do we navigate influencing our culture without forcing Christian values on those who reject them? What are the boundaries here? Let's talk about it today on Takeaways. How do I advocate for biblical, faith-driven values without being pushy and people thinking that I'm trying to make them live under my rules?
Let people know what your convictions are and why you have them.
But don't make it as if disagreeing with you means that we can't be friends and we can't continue the conversation.
Why is religious freedom the mother of all freedoms?
The government has no right
to get in the way of your religious conscience and to be able to worship your Creator.
Okay, joining us now is past Arkansas governor and popular communicator of conservative values, Mike Huckabee. Governor Huckabee also hosts his own hit show, Huckabee, right here on TBN. Mike, thank you so much for joining us for this crucial conversation. I'm really excited to talk with you because you can give us a perspective from so many different sides. You've been a pastor, you've been a state governor, you've been a communicator publicly on cultural issues, and you can play bass like Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, you're my guy. So.
Well, that's very kind. What you basically are saying, Kirk, is that one of these days I'm gonna find something I'm good enough to stick with. But in the meantime, I've got all these different things that I've done, but it's such a pleasure to be with you. I so admire you, and I'm very, very happy to get to have this conversation.
Well, you're so kind, and you do wear so many different hats, and I'm thrilled to see that you're now wearing a beard. I am too. You know, they say that they actually, we have words for people who don't grow beards, women and children.
Yeah, I finally got old enough to grow one. Yeah. And I'm thinking about becoming the bass player in a ZZ Top tribute band. So I needed to get a good head start. Maybe in about 5 or 10 years, I'll have enough whiskers to be able to do it.
That's great. Well, Mike, I want to ask you this question. In today's climate, politically, culturally, economically, spiritually, politically, we need good leaders. We're all looking for good leaders. And good leaders are the ones who have been tasked with making the hard decisions. And decisions are particularly difficult in a culture where there seems to be so many people are polarized and divided. And you've got to make decisions as a leader that affect a lot of people, even people who won't agree with your decisions. So how do you, as a pastor, as a governor, how do you make decisions wisely? What are the factors and the influencing elements that can help us do that?
Well, even since my teen years, I've always lived by a few principles. One of them is lead by loving, not by shoving. Nobody wants to be pushed into something. Good leaders don't get behind people and kick them in the backside and tell them what they're gonna do. They get in front and they say, follow me. Mm. And so that's good leadership to begin with. The second thing I believe is very important, leaders never ask others to do what they're unwilling to do. You see people who say, you go do this because it's a small job and I'm too big for it. No, leaders are willing to set up the chairs. They're willing to clean the tables off. Now, sometimes it may not be practical that the leaders do it, but the people in an organization need to know that you're willing to do anything you ask them to do. Mm. But I think by the bigger question of how do you get to the decision point, especially when you're trying to influence, a lot of it comes down to make sure you know deep down that what you're putting forth is something that you believe out of conviction, not out of political or organizational convenience. I see a lot of people, they kind of take a poll, they put their finger in the air and see which way the wind is blowing, and that's the way they go. It's a terrible way to lead. I believe leadership is a whole lot like being a musician. Before you play the song, you have to tune the instrument. So the question is, to what do we tune? And any musician knows, you don't tune to what you think, feel, or believe. You tune to an unchanging, very rigid musical standard so that the C note is the same in Tokyo as it is in Japan, in New York or in Mississippi. The C note is always exactly the same tone. And therefore, everyone, whether you play a trumpet or you play a guitar or piano, you have to play according to a very fixed standard. For Christians, it's pretty simple. The standard is the scripture. We tune ourselves to the Word of God. And if we tune ourselves to what we think or what we feel or what we believe, we're going to play a lousy song. It's going to be a train wreck. And it'll be noise. And it'll sound like chaos. And that's why I truly believe that the number one characteristic of leadership is making sure that our own lives and our own convictions are tuned to something way bigger than us, certainly bigger than our feelings, bigger than our thoughts, bigger than our own personal beliefs. We can't live as it was in the time of Judges when everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Mike, I'm so thankful to be talking with someone who has so much wisdom. I love and want to just double click on what you just said and go back in there and really listen again to that great advice. Once you've made a good decision, and now you have other people who are you know, yelling at you from the the peanut gallery, going, that was a terrible decision. How are you able to find common ground with people who don't like the decisions that you make?
You know, the things that I learned as governor when I had a legislature that was 90% the other party. So it was tough. It wasn't like these were guys who came to work every day saying, what can we do to make Huckabee look good? It was like, what can we do to get rid of this guy?
Right.
So I walked into the Capitol every day knowing that I wasn't surrounded by people who wanted me to succeed, but I knew they wanted to succeed. Quite frankly, the key is that we ask ourselves, what does the other person want out of this? What is it that they want? And if I don't know, I ask them, what, guys, do you think is the single most important thing we've got to get done in education? Listen carefully and figure out what you can do to give them as much of what they want. Start from the basis of where you agree. Never start from the point at which you disagree. I see a lot of people make the big mistake of going into a negotiation, and it could be a negotiation for anything, even could be between a husband and wife. And if you walk in and say, okay, here's the part where we don't even agree, let's start there. Huge mistake, you've already lost. Walk in and figure out on what things, even if it's small things, little bitty things, what do we agree on? And build from that outward, and it makes a whole lot of difference.
Man, that is so good. That would work in marriage. That works if we're considering the needs of others before our own and saying, how can I help them accomplish their goal? And then, you know, people are more willing to reciprocate and compromise. I love that. Some people, Governor Huckabee, are feeling that it's their responsibility to so represent purity and truth with regard to their religious beliefs, their political beliefs, that they can't lock arms and work together with people who don't share their same orthodoxy. Right? So can I work with a Jewish person as a Christian? Can I work with a Democrat as a Republican or a Libertarian as a Democrat for a common cause without looking like I'm compromising? And what issues would be worthy of doing something like that? Like, is freedom of speech a big enough issue? Is freedom of worship a big enough issue to reach across the aisle or into the temple or the mosque and work with people that are different than me?
Not only is it something we can do, it's something we must do. I cannot say it loudly enough and strongly enough. One of the basis of living life and living in a world where people are different is being able to help them to understand that I'm not their enemy. I'm not waking up every day wanting to destroy what they believe. There's so many issues. For example, right now I'm working with the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Now, this is largely a Jewish organization that raises money from Christian people to help impoverished Jewish people in God's land of Israel. And you might wonder why? Because it's an incredibly powerful witness to say to impoverished Jews, your Christian friends in America love you. They do? I didn't know they cared about me. Yeah, they do. And they're helping to bring a food box to you. There are other ways. For example, if it's a political issue and I want to make sure that we get fresh water to a community that has lousy water, do I care whether it's a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian who helps get that clean water to a community where they desperately need it? Of course not. The issue is water. The issue is not who delivered it. Who drives the truck is not as important as what's in the back of that truck that gets delivered. That's why I would just say to all my Christian brothers and sisters, for heaven's sakes, look for opportunities to link arms with people who are as different from you as possible. Here's a couple of examples. Right now, an unusual relationship is being formed between feminist and evangelical Christians on the issue of ensuring that girls can play girl sports without having biological males come in and disrupt and destroy the capacity for women to compete. Now, that's not a typical marriage, feminist and evangelicals, but it makes perfect sense. Feminists are doing it because they don't want women to lose the things they fought so hard for under Title IX. Evangelicals, because we believe that God created male and female and that there's a distinct difference between the two. But here's an area on which two unlikely entities not only can agree, but work together for the common good of women's sports. Why wouldn't we want to do that? I think it's a wonderful way to show that, you know, we're not afraid of anybody whose worldview may be different than ours. And if there are points at which we could agree, for example, I'm unapologetically pro-life. There's a group called Feminist for Life. Man, I'll join with them any day. A group called Democrats for Life. I'll be right there with them because they're standing for something that is important to me. So yes, we need to always look for ways and find the partnerships that help people in a broader sense than our own very narrowly focused interest.
I love the examples, in the real world examples that you just gave, and I could think of another one. The pastor of the church that I've been a part of over these last couple of years has done a beautiful job of welcoming people during the pandemic times into the fellowship who have very different beliefs. We have Jewish people at our Christian church, and we have even atheists and agnostics who are coming to church not because of any religious reason. They simply have the common value of loving freedom. And these are surfers and skaters who are being kicked off of the beaches and sand is being thrown into their skate parks. Their streams of liberty are drying up, and so they're moving upstream looking for the source of that liberty. And what they're discovering is that liberty is God's idea, not man's idea. So they're coming to the church to hear more about where liberty comes from. And in that context, they're able to hear the life-giving message of the gospel. And that wouldn't have taken place if we don't look to broaden the circle and say, where do we have common ground and what can we fight for together? I can help you, you can help me. And that might start a relationship where we have further conversations that lead to further truth.
That is such a wonderful example, Kurt. I mean, it thrills me to hear that because it's a great reminder that when Jesus went out into the community, he didn't just go to the synagogue and say, okay, the only people I care about are the religious people, the people who think like me. He walked out into the community and he found fishermen and tax collectors, the most hated people in the community, the tax collectors. And he said, you know, I want to come to your house, Zacchaeus, and have dinner with you.
That's right.
This is how we change the world, one person at a time, but we do it by loving people, not by condemning people. And I just think that's a beautiful and a brilliant way. It's sort of like that line in the movie Jerry Maguire, help me help you. That was the line. Help me help you. And sometimes that's what we do as believers, ask people, you know, help me help you. And we do that.
What I think is important now is for us to discuss each person's individual role as an everyday believer. Let me ask you this question. Some people would say that I have trouble standing up for what I believe in because I'm afraid it's going to give people the impression that I'm trying to push my values on them. How do I advocate for biblical, faith-driven values without being pushy and people thinking that I'm trying to make them live under my rules? What do you say about that?
I think a lot of it is simple attitude. If we give the attitude that, look, if you don't believe like me, you're just dead wrong, and you're going to split hell wide open, as the saying down south used to be, well, that's not a very effective way to build a bridge. But it's about loving people and saying, look, I know there's some things with which we disagree, but here's where I'm coming from on this. It's important to me, but I respect and appreciate if you don't see it that way. In other words, let people know what your convictions are and why you have them. The why is important. But don't make it as if disagreeing with you means that we can't be friends and we can't continue the conversation. That's what we have to do, is make that divide. Have the humility to always have a learning spirit, a teachable spirit. And that goes a long way, even with people that will never agree with some of our biblical convictions.
I love that. Even my wife says, Kirk, sometimes it's not what you say, it's how you say it. That's what's making it so difficult.
Yeah.
All right, and you're talking about we need to communicate in kind and gracious ways. But, you know, I back to this idea of forcing our beliefs on other people and how we, some people would say, you know, of course we don't want to do that. Well, I think the idea of values being forced on everybody in a society is inescapable. I mean, if you think about it, we live in America. We are one nation under God, and we live under rules called laws. And those laws are based on a certain set of moral values. And every one of us is equal under the law. And all of us have to abide by the speed limit, and you can't steal, and you can't murder, you can't do those things. So really the question is not whether or not a set of values can be required to be kept by all the people. It's just a question of whose values should be the basis for the laws in the nation. And I think it should be the values that are going to produce the most freedom and the most flourishing for both believers and non-believers alike.
We never need to apologize for what we believe or why we believe it. We just need to explain it. Some people still won't agree with it. But one of the ways in which we should try to work to bring a worldview into the law and into society and culture is to remind people that we're living by two parallel value systems. One is a biblical worldview, which is Judeo-Christian, which unapologetically and without dispute was the moral foundation upon which the country is founded. The other is our Constitution, which is that social contract that we have agreed would be the foundation and the essence of all of the laws that we ever create. And say, we're just trying to be consistent with that. We should never apologize. Now, be clear, there are going to be people who will be angry if they don't get their way. And sometimes we just have to smile and say, you know, I'm sorry, we won that time. Here's what I would say. There's three steps in trying to get something accomplished. One, try to win. And when you win, win with humility and with a sense of graciousness toward those who didn't win. Secondly, if you can't win, influence. Make sure that you put enough salt in that to preserve something of what your values are. Keep some light in the darkness. So try not to make it an all or nothing proposition. Biggest mistake I see people make in politics, they go into it and it's all or nothing, now or never. And when you have that attitude, you get nothing and you get it forever. So if you can't win outright, have some influence. And finally, just make sure that regardless of the outcome, that you stick true and faithful to your biblical convictions. Because at some point, when the other side's attitude, for example, is say in criminal justice, fails miserably, they may want to come back and say, now what was it that you said, and how would that be helpful? So I would just remind people, you don't win every time. When you don't, live to fight another day.
I love talking with you, Governor, because you're so unlike so many politicians. You exude these kindness and courage and biblical values, but you're also not like a lot of pastors because you're willing to talk about politics. Most pastors seem to avoid politics like they avoid the coronavirus. And I actually appreciate when a man of wisdom and faith is actually willing to engage in cultural leadership positions, because that brings happiness to the people. And that's me. I'm not only a member of the family of faith sitting in a church, I'm also a citizen of this country with kids, and I'm looking for a future for them. What would you say to encourage pastors to have some courage and begin to speak on these issues that are affecting schools and businesses and our government?
Well, I would ask them, if you as a pastor are not going to influence your community, whether it's through the school board or the city council or the state legislature or through the national Congress, then who is? Because somebody's going to influence. And if it's not you, and if it's not other Christian believers, then basically you have surrendered it to people who are with great antithesis toward your own value system. So we get what we surrender to, which means the reason we have a million abortions a year is because there weren't enough people like Amos and Jeremiah who were prophetic to say, that's not right. And so we don't have to be angry. We don't have to be mean. We don't have to even make it that our political agenda is equal to our eternal agenda. But we should never be apologetic. Never should we surrender those biblical convictions, because if we believe that they're truth, then we believe that they're good for people, that a wholesome marriage is better than a divorce, that loving our children and raising them in nurture and admonition of the Lord is better than ignoring them or beating them or abusing them, that being honest with people in business and treating them right is better than cheating people, makes for a better economy. So everything that we want to put forth has a practical benefit, and we need to always remind people of that practical benefit, but never apologize, because quite frankly, if we don't believe in it enough to stand for it, we really don't believe in it very much.
Man, why didn't you win the presidential election? That's another episode.
I've asked myself that many times. I don't know.
Wow, this is so good. I could just talk to you for hours. Mike, many people feel like living in America is like living on a slowly sinking ship. They feel like our values, our faith is just, it's been under attack, and we're watching the demise of a great nation. Will you speak to your hope in this country? Do you think it's possible to right the ship? Can we turn America around? And if so, what's the path to being able to do that?
Oh, I definitely believe it can be done. And I hope it will be done, because, you know, God is the God of great things. He's the God of great turnarounds. And so here's what I feel has to happen. The people who know Him must get on their faces before Him, repent of the sin of neglect of this country and of our responsibilities, and say, God, here am I, send me.
Yep.
That's first. And then it's praying and believing that God is going to do something big. Here's what I do believe is beginning to happen. Hadn't happened yet, but it's starting. People are beginning to wake up to the nuttiness of the godless worldview that says, just do whatever I want to do.
Yep.
And we're seeing a complete breakdown of family, the breakdown of civil society, riots in the streets, people hating the very people who are there to enforce it and saying, get rid of the cops. I mean, that's nonsense. And folks are scratching their heads and saying, wait a minute, this stuff's gone too far. Perfect opportunity for us to step in and say, there is another way, and it's a better way. And it's called order, decency, respect. It basically comes down to this one rule taught by a guy named Jesus. And that's this: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Let's live that way. It changed the world. And that's a message that'll still work.
I think it works every time. I think it's timeless. I think you're exactly right. And this could be the church's finest hour. Governor, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Charlie Kirk about preserving religious freedoms in our country. What an excellent conversation that we just had with Governor Huckabee about Christian influence in our culture. Now, I want to shift the conversation to religious freedoms. They were foundational, essential to the creation of America. But now, are they under attack? Charlie Kirk is the founder and the president of Turning Point USA. It's the largest and the fastest growing conservative youth activist organization in the country, and he's joining us now to discuss this. Charlie, great to see you.
Great to see you, Kirk. You're a great American. Honored to call you a friend and glad to be here.
You know, I thank you. I want to just thank you for putting my name on the backdrop behind you the way that you have so prominently. It actually looks like the Charlie and Kirk show, if you take a look.
Yes, that's right.
Should we make
co-hosts?
We could make the announcement right now to everybody.
I have the last name, you have the first name, and that's I haven't met a Kirk yet, but I'm sure someone's out there.
Hey, my son just came back from TPUSA's Student Action Summit in Florida. He was blown away. He was just set on fire. That's an amazing thing. What was your takeaway from SAS?
It was exhausting for, you know, all of us that organized it, but it was amazing, Kirk. We had over 4,000 students from all across the country in Tampa, Florida. Some of the most amazing speakers you can imagine. Kayleigh McEnany, Governor Ron DeSantis, Mike Pompeo, Senator Ted Cruz, and more. And the team did an absolutely incredible job in their execution of the event in the first class way that we went about doing everything. It was the largest ever young conservative gathering in American history. And that's exactly why most people don't even know what happened, because the media refused to cover it. They don't like showing that there's people that are gathering around first principles and God-granted rights and the Constitution and free speech and American exceptionalism. And so super pleased that your son had a great time, and we've been hearing lots of stories like that. Praise God.
Well, that's what I love about what you do, too, is you're not only motivating people with great speakers and cool events for young people, but you're also educating them about the things that they're often not hearing in their schools, particularly public schools, for sure. But even private schools, even faith-based schools, are not teaching these kinds of principles without which we don't have a republic like we do. One of those principles is religious freedoms. When I was in school as a kid, I didn't really learn much about that at all. In fact, I wasn't religious. And so for me, I didn't even really care about the subject. But to our founders, it was absolutely essential. Why is religious freedom the mother of all freedoms?
First and foremost, it's the freedom to worship your own creator, the reason why you exist. And also, the founding fathers designed this system of self-government, believing that only with a moral and religious people this was possible. It's John Adams' quote where he said, "The Constitution was written solely for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the people of any other." And so limited government is only possible when people are able to regulate their own decisions and conduct, particularly in religious communities, or having at least the church or the worship of God as a centerpiece of your life. So this idea of liberty, the way that the founding fathers understood liberty, is not the traditional libertarian view of liberty that we've come to realize in America. It's the ability to pursue virtue without somebody getting in the way. The necessity of virtue was fundamental to the American founding. 55 out of 56 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Christians who regularly attended church. At least a dozen, Kirk, were pastors, and maybe even more.
Right.
And more than that, had religious degrees of people that went to religious institutions. State barriers and boundaries were actually the beginning and the end of certain religious traditions that had certain perspectives on which strain of Protestantism was the best and most effective way to practice Christianity. For example, Pennsylvania was heavily Quaker, right? We all know that example. And so the founding fathers were only able to articulate a doctrine of separation, were able to participate in the separation of the British people and then a creation of a new government because they understood the teachings of the Bible and they understood the moral right to religious freedom. Religious freedom in the United States Constitution is unlike anything else. It's mentioned twice in two different ways. The first is in the Establishment Clause, and the second is in the Free Expression Clause. The Establishment Clause is that Congress shall make no religion. And this was actually not that religion has no place in government, but it was a promise to every single strain of Protestant tradition in the colonial times that it was not going to become an Anglican or Episcopalian or Quaker or Presbyterian or Lutheran country that every single denomination would be respected. The free expression clause is the most important, though, that the government has no right to get in the way of your religious conscience, your ability to gather, to assemble, and to be able to worship your Creator. This is a unique attribute and characteristic of the American system. And as soon as you lose religious freedom, state control then begins to set in.
You know, you said something earlier on in that answer where you said that the only reason we're able to handle freedom in America is because people have understood the value of self-government. And really what that is the pursuit of virtue. But how does that relate to being religious? Right? Were the founders just saying, well, we just prefer that people are religious, and yeah, a lot of us were pastors and ministers, but someone might say, wait, Charlie, are you implying that in order to be virtuous, you've got to have a religious root in there? Is it really that important, or can't we just be atheists and be good?
Yeah, I'm sure there's good atheists. I get this question a lot. There's a lot of good atheists out there. They're good because they're practicing the Judeo-Christian ethic. They just don't want to admit it. The question is,
yeah,
what is the good?
If we practice the Darwinian ethic, I could end up eating my neighbor because I'm fitter and I'm surviving.
Precisely. That's right. And so the question is, what is good? I always ask young people, I say, well, what do you mean I can't be a good atheist? I said, you could be a good atheist. I've never said that. Where do you get this definition of good from? What is right? What is transcendent? What is evil? These are really big questions. And thankfully, we have an amazing tradition in the Christian world of what all these things mean. It's good to try to grow closer to your Creator. It's good to defend the innocent. It's good to tell the truth. It's evil to call good evil and evil good. It's evil to turn your back on those that can't defend themselves. It's evil to disobey your parents. It's evil to take another life. We take this for granted because it's kind of been meshed into the DNA of Western culture.
Right.
And it's not normative to the human experience. So to answer your question, freedom is not sustainable if you remove religion. And I'll be even more specific. Freedom is not sustainable if you remove Christianity. Eventually, it will implode. Eventually, you will be ruled simply by your senses. You'll be ruled simply by your consciousness.
That's
right. I'm a big lover of reason. I think reason is a gift from the Lord. It says in Isaiah 1, let us reason together. But reason without revelation, reason without the belief in a transcendent order, will go exactly where you articulated it, Kirk.
Yep.
It will go to where John Stuart Mill or where Darwin articulated, which is the survival of the fittest, a eugenicist type experiment. And we as Christians should reject that.
Charlie, just lastly, before we go away to a break, this idea of the separation of church and state still seems to come up. Even though it's not in the Constitution, it's not in the Bill of Rights, there's a principle there that people get entirely backwards and upside down, thinking that that is the reason why we shouldn't talk about God or faith in the government. Is that true?
No. I mean, it's in a single letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Convention. It's not in the Constitution. It's not in the Declaration. It's not in the Bill of Rights. It's not in the Federalist Papers. It's not in any of those foundational documents that really formed this republic that we have. It was adopted by the Warren Burger Court in the 1960s and 70s as a reason to get prayer out of schools. But let's pretend they were right, Kirk. Let's pretend that they were right for a second, even though they're not. Then why don't they keep the state out of the church? Why don't they keep the public health officials from going into churches and locking them down? I thought they want separation of church and state. They can't even be consistent with their own lies.
Right.
Even if they were right, Kirk, this last year with the lockdowns, no church would have been forced to close. No church would be facing fines like Mike McClure at Calvary Chapel, San Jose.
Yeah.
In fact, they've never believed that. The only thing they believed is that the state can do whatever you want. The church should not try to influence the state. This is rubbish. The founding fathers always believed that Christians deserved to be counselors to the king. Not deserved, they needed to be counselors
That's
to the
right.
king. The people whispering in the ear of the leaders, counseling them, do this and don't do that. The church has abdicated its moral place to be counseling the king or counseling the political leaders in our country, and we see the result of that.
That is so true, because I think religion is inescapable for us as human beings and as a culture. And if we kick God off of the throne, we can't really do that. But in our minds, if we want to play make-believe and think we can do that, that creates a vacuum. And then we, as a man, a group of people, corporately as a state, we'll assume the position of the God of our culture, the supreme dictator from which all authority flows, all laws flow, and then we end up bowing down to a totalitarian government, which you're doing such a fantastic job of keeping from happening in the minds of young people, and I thank you. Charlie, let's get practical. I want to talk about how you and me and the people that are watching can practically do something to practice religious freedom, because if we don't practice it, it's going to go away, and how we can protect it from those who are taking it away from us. What are you personally doing? I mean, I know you've got TPUSA organizationally, you've got SAS, these fantastic, amazing events for young people, but I've seen you in some TikTok and YouTube videos where you're actually speaking at school board meetings or at city council meetings. Yes. I can't remember which one, but talk about some of these boots on the ground, everyday things that you're doing that other people can do too.
Yes, I mean, everyone should be showing up to school board meetings all across the country. We're gonna be showing up to the Scottsdale Unified School District meeting whenever it is, if they allow us to, because they keep going mobily and virtually, because they're afraid to actually face the citizens. I'm a taxpayer in Scottsdale, and they are doing some really sinister stuff. Let me tell you what, Kirk. And I'm not going to put up with it. I went to the Chandler Unified School District, also a payer of income tax in Arizona, so showed up there. We have to be active, be involved, and show up at all these meetings, Kirk. The other thing is this, though, is that people say, what do I do? What do I do? I ask them, are you the same person publicly that you are privately? That's the most important thing that you just have to do. No more disguising yourself when you leave your home. No more that you got to put on the jersey of being kind of this like secular liberal when you're at work. No. You are living under the tyranny of other pressure. Yes, you might lose your job. Yes, you might lose your friends. But the moment that you have to now pretend to be somebody you're not in social situations, then they've won. The minute that breaks, then all of a sudden they're going to start to lose. Their power is in their ability to make us to conform. I believe it's Romans 8:12 or Romans 12:8. This is how I kind of get the numbers screwed up at times. Do not conform to the ways of this world. It is a biblical teaching to not conform to the ways of this world. Yet so often, Kirk, the number one piece of feedback I get on our program here on our podcast, and you've been on our podcast before, Kirk, I'd love to have everyone check it out, is that they tell us, Charlie, I'm afraid I will lose this, 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 this. And I say, that fear is a tactic used by the enemy to silence truth.
Right.
And that fear is understandable. But if you succumb to that fear, then all of a sudden you are playing into the greatest weapon used by the opposition.
So who are the biggest thieves? Where should we be looking to say, okay, that's an area where they're looking to strip me of my religious freedoms and my ability to be who I am privately when I'm in public?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest is forcible jobs, forcing you to lose your job, mockery, ridicule, isolation, if you have a different view. And the biggest thing is this, is that if you get a knot in your stomach because you're afraid to speak out at a friend's house about a political matter or a social matter or a religious matter, that's the testing point. If you get a knot in your stomach at work about that, and look, I'm not going to counsel you to be brash. You have to have prudence. You have to have practical judgment when you do these things. You shouldn't just rush into it and just start screaming at your, work that, vaccines are like, I don't want to take the vaccine or whatever, right? That's not what I'm saying, because some people are doing that and that's not wise. What I am saying, though, is when asked or pressured or prodded, don't lie. Tell the truth. Hmm. Tell the truth in every single thing. I can tell you this. People say, Charlie, how are you able to do what you do? It's so simple. I say the exact same things privately to our production meeting of our podcast that I say on the show. That's the secret to our success. There is no separation here. And my team is laughing because they're like, yep, that's right. There's no camouflaging. There's no disguising. There's no poll testing. What is true? This is what I'm going to say. I encourage other people to do that. And by the way, it's not easy, but it's so liberating, Kirk. It's so beautiful. You never have to worry about being restrained to another, looking around your shoulder, the cost of speaking your mind. It's freedom that truly comes from the Lord.
Well, I agree. And as an actor, I have made my living being somebody publicly that I am not privately, right? That's what we do for a living. And so we get really good at it. And so for me, I've got to unlearn what has become so natural. Yes. And we, most of us know that this is going to come at some kind of a cost. Like you said, losing your job is a big deal for someone who doesn't have a big social media platform to be able to get other ways of getting their message out, other ways of monetizing all the good work that they're doing. And so understandably, it's like, well, what do I do? But if we all do it, and if we join together voluntary unions and we begin to associate with one another, we can then begin rebuilding the systems and the institutions, which is what we should have been doing from the beginning, rather than relying on platforms built by people who want to destroy our message, right? That would be like Jesus trying to depend on the Pharisees to disseminate his gospel to Israel. You'd be like, well, of course they're not going to want to do that. And so he created his own discipleship program and sending them out, right? And that's what we need to begin doing. And I see people are doing it because we have no choice now. I love it.
Yeah, that's right, Kirk. And I just want to acknowledge something. There is a cost to this. I'm not going to lie to our audience. I'm not going to lie to your audience. And I'm also not going to say if you do nothing, you're a coward. I am not saying that. A lot of people have different pressures and may have different decisions to make, bills to pay, children to take care of.
That's right.
So I'm not just I'm not doing this. I'm not saying you're a bad person. What I am saying, though, is people say, what do I do? Well, that's an action step. But brave and courageous and moral things, Kirk, rarely don't come without a cost.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
right. I mean, think about that. People want the glory. They want the valor. They want the recognition, but they don't want to have to go through the cost to do that.
That's right.
And what I'm just trying to be honest with people is, if you want to do something meaningful, then you have to be willing to sacrifice for that something.
What are some things that encourage you that you see other young people doing in America right now? Are there some examples that you can share? Like, okay, let me tell you what some of these guys did.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of young people start to run for office. I'm seeing a lot of young people get involved in their local school boards, participate in FOIAs, Freedom of Information Act requests, to actually get documents from their school boards. I'm seeing a ton of movement, Kirk, that is really giving me hope and promise. I'm seeing parents start to rise up. But do you know what gives me the most amount of hope is how true I know our message is. That's what gives me hope.
Yeah.
And as long as we have people keep on repeating things that are true, it says in the scriptures, Philippians 4:8, whatever is true, whatever is good, ponder on these things, defend these things. If you go back to the Greek, it is to take care of these things, to nurture them. Then that's what we got to do. And look, Jesus Christ, logos, which means reason, truth, there's a lot of different ways to describe the word logos in the New Testament. That's spoke about in the book of John. But Jesus was truth. He didn't just say true things. He was the embodiment of truth. And if I'm going to be honest, we as Christians have gotten away from our commitment to always telling the truth all the time. And it's not to say that people tell lies a lot. It's that they're living a lie. It's that they have to go pretend to go put on some costume and jersey at school or work and to be someone that they aren't. That's the same thing as telling a lie, by the way, Kirk. That's the same thing as saying that black is actually white and white is actually black. When you have to go to school and you're like, well, what do you think about this, Johnny? Oh, I think that that there is no God, and I don't know. Next question. That's just as bad, Kirk, is living out something you don't believe. So my call to action is that courage is only moral when it's rooted in truth. If we have the truth, we have to act on it, and that's when things are going to start to change.
I love that. I love that. When I think of how courageous you are, when I think of how courageous pastors are like Rob McCoy and Jack Hibbs and others, and I think of so many people who spoke at the SAS meetings, we look at that and I go, man, how do you get that kind of courage? And I think what you said is exactly right, is that we have the truth on our side. For crying out loud, there is a God yes. in heaven who governs in the affairs of men, and he's a God of justice and truth. Now, that could go bad for us if we're actually doing bad things and our nation comes under a time of judgment. But if our cause is just, he's going to make that shine. He's behind us. He's the wind in the sails for truth to push us to the finish line. And that makes me excited. And then I also think about the flip side, and I think, man, if we don't stand up with courage and we just back down as cowards, history tells me where our republic will go. And I can't believe anybody wants to go there. And I think the people don't. No one wants to live in totalitarian countries where they have no freedom, except the people that are running the joint. It's great for them because they have all the freedom.
Yes.
And they're for freedom too, actually, just their own freedom to do anything that they want and use the people as pawns and tools to advance their own kingdom with them as gods. So it's both. We have a lot at stake. Let me ask you this one final question. If we could bring back the value for religious freedom and we could re-enshrine it and celebrate it and defend it all across this nation, what would be the positive effects that we would begin to see culturally?
Yeah, we would see a revival, and we would see people start to put God first, which is what we need to do. We need to try to recreate a transcendent order. We need to try to recreate this idea of a properly ordered hierarchy. And that's the true thing that we need to have right now. And look, religious freedom is under attack in a very scary way in our country and in our nation. It's only going to change when the faithful start to commit to freedom. The most important thing you could do in your life is give your life to Jesus Christ. Mm. The second most important thing is make sure you could do the first thing.
Give your life to Jesus Christ. Second thing, make sure that you have the freedom to do that. Charlie, why should non-religious people care about religious freedom? If they say, not my issue, you deal with it, why are they making a big mistake?
Yeah, they're wrong, because the church is all that is preventing totalitarianism from setting in.
Exactly.
If you're enjoying the surpluses of the fruit of the American system, the church and religious freedom is what keeps this entire society ordered together. You're starting to see this disintegrate. Even secular people that I know, they don't want to live in secular places anymore. Do you notice that?
Right.
Secular people I know don't want to live in New York anymore. They don't want to live in LA anymore. They're like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to Texas. I wonder why you're going to Texas. Is it that because they've actually honored religious liberty and freedom for longer? Oh, I want to go to Arizona. I wonder why. Why aren't you moving to Portland? Like, why aren't you moving to Seattle?
Right.
So even the secular types, they themselves admit that cities and areas that have had more of a reverence for God and for tradition and for order and for the church are actually nicer places to live, Kirk.
Yeah.
It's actually more beautiful. And what I mean by beautiful is that which is perfected in being. Less homelessness, less vagrancy, anti-American nonsense. The economy's more robust. You're looking up for the fellow neighbor. Crime is down. All these things just kind of fall into place, kind of mysteriously, not so mysteriously actually for the secular folks out there, when you actually have religious freedom that is preserved and protected. And you could see this. I joke around with some of my secular friends. They're like, oh, I'm moving out of Boston. I'm moving out of New York. It's the worst place ever. I'm like, where are you going? Tennessee. I'm like, oh, really? I wonder, 10 years ago, the secular types were making fun of Tennessee because it was the Bible Belt in the southern part of America.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, it's super desirable. I wonder why. I wonder why they have their act together. It's because they've put God first. Now, they're losing that in some sense, but still, there's this remnant of a society that was created by the Christian ethic that even secular types want to live under. All people should care about religious freedom if you care about the well-being of humanity.
That's right. That's right. And I know that Benjamin Franklin understood that, and some of our founders who were more irreligious than others, or less religious, I should say, they understood that Christianity was the ground that they were standing on in order to keep their beliefs without being persecuted for them. And so I think, man, if you've got a freaky flag to fly, America's the place to fly it. Try to go fly that flag in another country in the Middle East. It's not going to go so well for you. Yet, we're advocating for similar kinds of government ultimate totalitarian rule that is going to make this country like those places. That's just insanity. Right. It's suicidal thinking.
That's right. That's exactly right, Kirk. And so if you remove the church, you remove faith, all of a sudden all this other freedom we enjoy goes away.
I've been blown away by the conversations that we had today. So much great information and truth. And as with every episode of Takeaways, I want to distill everything into a few actionable items, takeaways, for us to use to improve ourselves, our families, and our communities. One, love, don't shove. We learned from Governor Huckabee that if you're wanting to influence culture and work with those who don't agree with your values, we have to start with what we have in common and learn what's important to them. Let's focus on areas that we do agree on and build a bridge of trust rather than trying to start with our disagreements. Two, tune yourself to Scripture. It's important, especially in this day and age, that we know what the Bible says. Tuning ourselves to Scripture and knowing God's heart will give us a clear path to knowing what our non-negotiables are. It'll also give us wisdom to know when to compromise and when to draw lines of distinction. Three, be the same person you are in public as you are in private. As Charlie talked about, we as believers need to not be afraid to live out our faith in public. It's important that we speak up in order to maintain the freedoms that we've been given by God and be able to worship Him without fear. Four, tell the truth. Charlie also talked about how important it is that we bring light into darkness. We need to call out lies wherever they exist and tell the whole truth and not be afraid to do the right thing, even when it's hard. Joshua 1:9 says, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go." Hi, I'm Kirk Cameron. Thanks for listening to this episode of Takeaways. If you love the conversations that we're having, please follow or subscribe to this podcast to never miss any of this great content. And please consider leaving a positive rating and a review to help others like you discover this show.